This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Wings thanks Rabble Podcast Network for carrying our programs and urges listeners to contribute to their fundraiser. Please visit rabble.ca/donate today. Today on Wings.
I had to face the darkest expression of Islam very intimately, and I was afraid.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Asra Nomani is a well-known Indian-American journalist. She is also a revolutionary Muslim feminist, author of tracts such as The Islamic Bill of Rights for Women in the Mosque and The Islamic Bill of Rights for Women in the Bedroom. Her first book was called Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Today on Wings, Part 1 of Asra Nomani's speech at Yale University.
Thank you so much for having me come here. It's such an honor. I was a good Muslim girl growing up in West Virginia when my dad and mom told me, you're not going to go anywhere to college but our hometown university. I listened. But I'll be taking the college tour tomorrow morning just so I can, relive old memories that I never had. So when I was thinking about this talk, I wanted to call it Breaking the Silence and talk to you about this personal journey that I've taken and use that as a window into a larger revolution. The personal is oftentimes global, and that's why I think I'm here before you. Where I was as a little girl here in America, I came at the age of 4, part of the brain drain, out of India in the 1960s. My dad came for his PhD, and I joined later with my brother and was part of, so many immigrant stories here to America. I felt separate. I felt like I didn't belong. And so I went into writing as my place of expression. But writing was always private. It was always something for just myself. I didn't share my inner thoughts with anybody. I didn't even express them to my own parents. I just journaled and cried into my journal, like a lot of little girls might do. And the issues that started emerging as I, as an adult, look back at my journals are the ones that mark my work today. And one of them was a window into my younger self. I was raised first in New Jersey, and then we moved to West Virginia when I was 10. It was 1975, and the Muslim community in Morgantown was very open. We would gather, as we are gathered here. The men and the women would interact freely together. We would have our dinners openly. And then what happened in our Muslim community is what was happening globally through the 70s, a growing conservatism fueled in part by the exportation of more puritanical Islamic theology from the newly found wealth of oil-rich Saudi Arabia. And so into Morgantown came a lot of conservative ideas that included gender segregation. And so I didn't know the bigger politics, as a girl. I just knew my own personal experience with it. I went to a college dorm one night for a dinner party, much like you would have any dorm here. And we had the lobby downstairs. It was the medical center apartments. And the lobby was reserved for the men of our community. And I, along with the other women and girls, went, and we were sequestered away in one of the efficiency apartments where one of the Muslim families regularly lived. And As a little girl, I hated it. You know, I hated the fact that my brother was downstairs, you know, in the spacious room, running around freely, and I was cooped up in this little room. And the men would bring the aluminum foil, you know, trays of food and biryani and all of the other meals, and leave them at the door, knock, and then run away, as if to see us was to turn them to stone. And it was felt terrible and strange to me and foreign, because this wasn't the values and the ethics that my family embraced, even though my parents were very traditional and conservative. My father had had me, you know, stop wearing dresses when I was 9 because it was inappropriate for a girl to bare her legs, and I was definitely not allowed to go to the junior high school dances. But, you know, this kind of fear and separation was not part of their ethos. And so that night, in that little journal, I wrote that it felt like a prison, and I didn't like it, and I didn't express myself again. And that was part of the start of my silence. You know, that was when I was hitting the boundaries. I was hitting what in the Muslim world we know as the hudud, these boundaries that are supposed to define our values. And I was too afraid to cross them. You know, at that age, I didn't go downstairs. I didn't claim my right to the open space. I didn't even know really fully that I had that right as a girl within Islam. And so what happened for me is what I think happens to many girls and women within organized religion. And I started feeling disillusioned. You know, I started having a crisis of faith. I had been praying 5 times a day as a young girl, enthusiastic about memorizing the Quran. But with that experience and so many more, I started wondering, is there a place for me in the faith? Is in the rest of the world, you know, at West Virginia University, a woman named Judith Stitzel was starting the Women's Studies Department, and we were the first generation of the beneficiaries of the feminist movement in America. And I was told what all of you have been told, you know, growing up in America, for those of you who grew up here, that you could be everything that you wanted to be, that there were no limits to your dreams, that there were no closed doors, there were no boundaries for your dreams. And so this was a disconnect for me, because even though my parents mirrored that messaging, I thought my community and my religion didn't. And I didn't have the desire or the will to challenge. And so, like happens to a lot of people, I started leaving the faith. Increasingly through my teens and then into my 20s, I didn't feel like I could belong. And so I succeeded in the secular world. I became a reporter for the Wall Street Journal out of college, and, you know, interviewed CEOs and chiefs of staff and heads of state, but I never crossed the threshold of our mosque back in Morgantown, because since I was a little girl, I knew the rule. There wasn't room for me, literally, at the mosque. My brother would run with my father to the mosque for the Friday prayers, but my mother and I never went, and this was a message that was reinforced within the community, because none of the women became the leaders. You know, my father was a founding member of the board of our local mosque, but my mother and none of the other women who were the wives of the community leaders ever emerged to rise to the board seats of any of the Muslim leadership positions that we had. And so for me, this was my silence. This was my silence through my 20s and then into my early 30s. You know, I learned to become a great journalist by the highest standards of newspaper work, but I didn't touch any of the growing issues in the world regarding rising conservatism in the Muslim world. I knew through my own window into my family about the growing influence of Wahhabism, the theology of Saudi Arabia into the world. I knew it from the stories of my family in Pakistan. I could see my relatives growing increasingly conservative and rigid in their interpretations of Islam, but I never even wanted to go there. I didn't want to touch it. And so I crossed all sorts of boundaries. As a journalist, I started writing about issues of sexuality, got, you know, a story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about increasing safety issues because of so many people wanting to join the Mile High Club and airlines. I mean, I talked about the increasing number of people who didn't consummate their weddings because they already consummated their relationship so that it wasn't necessary on their wedding night to do the deed. So I would kind of push the envelope on societal issues, but I just, the things that resonated within me, issues that angered me and ones that I wondered about, but I didn't want to touch it because it was too close to home and I didn't feel like I could talk about these issues of religion with any seriousness because I felt like I didn't have a legitimacy because I had felt so disillusioned for so long that I didn't feel like I had a right to speak. And so, like a lot of people, September 11th was a wake-up call for me. I knew at that moment that I had to go to Pakistan and I had to try to write about Islam and I had to try to write about this world that seemed to be in clash with the West. And so I went to Pakistan and I reported for Salon magazine over there. I wanted to try to explain Islam. I wanted to try to explain more about the issues that were relevant in the Muslim world, try to explain extremism and this disconnect with the West. And there in Pakistan, I had what I guess is what Oprah calls, you know, your aha moment, right? Your moment when you just realize that you have been sleepwalking a lot through life. And I think this is a moment that comes to each one of us at some point or the other. For me, it was when my dear friend and colleague from the Wall Street Journal, Danny Pearl, came to visit at a house that I had rented in Karachi. I had decided I would stay there to finish writing my first book. I'd fallen in love with a man in Pakistan, and I was going to give it a try. I was going to find the divine love that I was pursuing as a journalist. And I thought I'd found it. You know, he was a good Muslim guy. He spoke my language. He was the immigrant dream, right? Bridging the world. And I was, you know, again in pursuit of this fantasy, really, that I had come to desire, trying to be the girl that I thought I was supposed to be. And so there I was in a house on a street called Zumzum, and my friend Danny came to visit with his wife, Marianne. She was just had a belly that was swelling from the conception of their baby. They just learned the day before that he was going to be a boy, and we celebrated. We tried to watch DVDs on his laptop that night, and I'd gone out and bought a 5-track CD player because I knew he loved music, and you know, ran and bought bootleg CDs of Bruce Springsteen and anyone else I could find just to show him I could show him a good time so they'd come back because I needed friends in Karachi, and that was then the last that I was going to see my friend because, as most of you know, he went for an interview where he thought that he was going to find the local handler for Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. And we waved goodbye outside my house. Danny was fumbling with everything as he normally did. And that was the last moment that we saw him. And the next that we saw of him were the images that most of you have probably seen of so many journalists now since then too, with a gun to his head, his hands in chains. And that was when I realized, you know, what serious business this world was in. I realized, too, what the stakes were for Islam in the world, because that first ransom note was from a group that called themselves the Group for the Sovereignty of Pakistan, and they said that they had kidnapped Danny because he was a Jewish, intelligence agent for Israel, and that they had kidnapped him in the name of Islam. And so sitting in my house on Zamzam Street, I heard all that the police were finding, that the photos had been dropped off at a mosque during a Friday prayer, that Omar Sheikh, who was later prosecuted as the mastermind, had plotted the kidnapping along with three others there in Karachi, breaking as the call to prayer would erupt around the city, and they would break their strategy sessions for prayer. And then we learned that, the people who had kidnapped were part of these militant groups that had emerged in Pakistan since the 70s. And I realized that people who call themselves Muslim had taken an innocent man, a man who was just eagerly awaiting his son's birth so that he could teach him how to play the mandolin one day. And I had a real sadness that this was the faith that my parents had taught me being practiced in this way. I'd lived through 9/11, I'd rushed to New York City, but it hit home now. It hit home in a very serious way. And would have been traumatic with just that level, but then I had to face the darkest expression of Islam very intimately a few weeks into Danny's kidnapping, when I learned that I was pregnant. I didn't have a wedding ring. I was single. My boyfriend had bailed on us the day after Danny's kidnapping because he didn't want to get involved in this international dragnet. And when I called him to tell him and saw him to tell him that I was pregnant, that universal fear kicked in, and he told me, I don't want to have anything to do with the baby. And I knew why, and I knew that, this was that taboo. I mean, this was a taboo that American women had to cross decades ago. This was the taboo that many women still have to face if they can. Pakistan was a country where the charitable organization left something called jhulas, cradles, in the yards of their charity organization so that people who had babies out of wedlock could leave them there so that they wouldn't get dumped in the garbage bins. And, I was afraid. I was afraid of getting my blood tests. I was afraid that I would get caught and dragged in, because now I was in the middle of the scene anyway that was full of all sorts of conspiracy. And there, then, in that moment, I had to confront the question of whether I was going to be able to take action, and action in the most intimate form of whether I was going to be able to stand up for life, basically, or abort my baby out of fear, because that's what I would have had to have done. It would have been fear of going into this world without a wedding ring and being a mother. And so these were the dilemmas and the issues spinning in my head as then I learned, along with the rest of the world, that Danny had been murdered, and had to confront this question of whether Islam was a violent religion. Is this what Islam taught us, that these men could cut him into pieces in the name of religion? I mean, was I supposed to also kill my baby inside of me for the name of religion, because that would keep me proper and legitimate? And this is what faced me, but I know that in so many people's lives there are other issues, there are other fears that we have to struggle with in trying to decide whether we can stand up or not. And so for me, the journey took me back to Morgantown, pregnant. My parents told me that they would welcome my baby into the world and they would support me, but still afraid, you know, so very much afraid. And it was with the birth of my son, then in October 2002, that I knew that I had to try to get my strength to stand up, because during that time, I heard of the case of Amina Lawal, a mother in Nigeria who had become pregnant and who was facing a stoning sentence. And I wrote an email to myself, you know, in the craze of my pregnancy, and I said, I have to get strong in order to speak out for women like her who can't. And through tears and anguish, I brought my son into this world, and when I saw him, for all of you who have, you know, had a newborn brought into your hand, you know, it was my rebirth. I mean, it was my new birth. It was the possibility and the potential of my new, stronger self. And so I went like that on a pilgrimage to Mecca that is the first half of what I write about in this book, Standing Alone in Mecca, where I wanted to go see for myself whether Islam, if there was a place for me in Islam, whether I, as a human being, as a woman without disguise, could feel like there was a place for me. And it was there that I walked, as every pilgrim has to do, in the footsteps of a great woman named Hagar, known as Hajar in Islam, a woman who is largely forgotten in history. Like so many women, Abraham had left her in the desert. She was the surrogate mother. She was the concubine. She was the slave. And she was a single mother. I mean, at the end of the day, she was a single mother in Mecca, raising her baby Ishmael. And as a Muslim, we are required on the pilgrimage to run in the footsteps of this woman who ran between two hills. And on her seventh run, desperately seeking water, holy water sprang from the earth, and this water was called Zamzam, the same name as the street on which I had lived in Karachi. And I realized as I felt her pulse that that Zamzam was within me. It was within all the women. It sprang, you know, from the earth through all of us, and I had the same potential as she did and all women do to overcome our fears and to find our rightful place and to know our full strength and to live fully self-determined lives. And I loved it. You know, I felt it didn't matter to me that the Saudis weren't going to let me get in a car and drive. I knew that I could be beyond that. Like, I knew there and then I had to cover every strand of my hair, but I knew that outside those boundaries I could be my full self, and I could harness the power of the symbolic woman who was the symbolic mother of Islam. And I returned to America with that determination. I didn't know how it was going to be expressed. I didn't know how I was going to realize it. But I came back to Morgantown, to this town where I had been told that I couldn't go downstairs, where I couldn't go into the mosque. And I saw the opportunity in this new mosque that had been opened up. And the mosque was a brand new $500,000 construction. And I thought, this is a new beginning. And so that was when I walked up to the front door and was greeted with the reality that has sadly come to define our Muslim world of the 21st century. You know, an elder standing at the door, pointing to the back door and yelling at me and saying, "Sister, take the back door." No greeting, no wishing of peace, no kindness. And what happened to me then? I mean, it is what happens to so many of us. You know, when you're taken, you know, you're this powerful, strong woman at that moment in any other place, and then all of a sudden, you are that younger self. I mean, you are that little girl who was told you can't go there, who was told stay in that corner and shut up and stay quiet. And I had the luxury of speaking to a great scholar at University of Georgia, you know, so angry at what had happened. And he said, Asra, you know, your anger reveals a deeper pain. And I knew that that was these decades of pain, of feeling disenfranchised, of being shut out, of not being able to go into the mosques of Pakistan, where I knew that, you know, my friend's photo had been distributed, you know, because this was a forbidden territory to me as a woman. And everything connected to me, you know, it wasn't just about me as an ordinary woman being excluded. It was about all women being excluded. It was about the doors of our Muslim world being closed to issues of tolerance and justice and equity. And, you know, normally if I hadn't had what had happened to me in Karachi happen, I would have walked away and never returned. I would not have cared. I would not have bothered. But I knew through my friend Danny's murder and through the question of my son's conception that I couldn't allow this kind of Islam to go unchallenged. And yet I had to confront that same thing that we all have to confront always, which is our own fear. I mean, I had decades of fear ingrained in me. I had, you know, crossed boundaries, jetted around the world, but I couldn't even walk from here to you to look over the wall of the balcony in which I was expected to sit in my mosque in Morgantown. And I knew it was all about fear. I mean, it was all about the fear of what was going to happen in response. It was the fear of the backlash. And then I watched a documentary about the life of the Prophet Muhammad. And I realized that, you know, the beauty of our faith in the 7th century has been tarnished and destroyed by just centuries of man-made rules and cultural traditions and tribalistic attitudes that, like has happened to so many societies and to so many faiths, erased the real beauty of religious teaching. And I couldn't allow it to continue as a Muslim because Islam was defining the future of our world. I had brought my son into this world. I had given him a Muslim name. I couldn't stand by anymore, silent. And so 10 days later, it took 10 days of this kind of soul searching, going in every day to the mosque. We went as a family, my mother and my niece, into the mosque, into the front door and into the main hall. And we unleashed this, you know, response of anger and yelling and screaming. And all the while, my dad hung with us. He stood there and he backed us up. And the journey, I knew, had begun.
Next on Wings, the exciting conclusion of Asra Nomani's speech at Yale University, followed by her interview with Melinda Tuhus, discussing the feminist movement and Islam.
It was the same struggle that the Prophet Muhammad had to make in the 7th century when he ruled that girls shouldn't be buried alive and that women should have divorce rights and that women should have inheritance rights. They pelted him with stones.
We left journalist Asra Nomani mounting the steps to a mosque in West Virginia, USA. Her immigrant family are longtime members of this mosque, but it started excluding females when she was a girl.
When I decided to go up those steps, I knew that something powerful was happening. I didn't know what, but I knew that there was no turning back.
Pregnant out of wedlock, Asra Nomani had to defy the hostile trend in Islam she'd seen spreading across the world.
I, in my own life, had made a decision that was going to be very revolutionary for me. By breaking the silence, we've challenged so many of these traditions that we've had to inherit as a Muslim community. Ideas that, you know, we have to stay silent in the mosque, that we can't assert ourselves, that women cannot be full citizens in our communities, that we are such a sexual temptation that we have to be hidden and separated and secluded. And we've really ignited a revolution, and I then wrote about it because that's what I knew how to do, but I'd never bothered to do it before. I did it, and I got hell for it. You know, I got the kind of hell that happens when you actually touch topics that aren't supposed to be talked about. And the response paralyzed me again. You know, I heard all the wickedness, right, about being an agent of corruption and enemy, you know, an agent of Satan, and my son should have been given up for adoption, and, you know, all of these things that are meant to ultimately humiliate you and silence you just because the assault is so intense. But then I watched Iron-Hearted Maidens, Iron-Hearted Angels on the suffragettes, and I knew, never having been a historian, I knew that this struggle was just the same as every other struggle for social justice in this world. It was the same struggle that the Prophet Muhammad had to make in the 7th century when he ruled that girls shouldn't be buried alive and that women should have divorce rights and that women should have inheritance rights. They pelted him with stones and threatened to kill him and tried to kill him. I mean, because it was about radical social revolution. And I realized, you know, that in the 21st century, I mean, so much of our struggles are so simple still. I mean, they're so simple that we don't have justice and tolerance and compassion defining our communities. And I knew that that this struggle for women's rights was part of a larger struggle. And so what we've done now in the last 2 years is made this a public issue, talking about it. Next week for your Islamic awareness programs, you all will have on campus a showing of a great documentary that's been done called The Mosque and Me. It's a remarkable program where Morgantown has a cameo appearance, but what is beautiful is that the voices of all of these disenfranchised women are spoken now, you know, and we've become such troublemakers that the mainstream organizations have had to pay attention. They've had to take notice. You know, they've known for decades that this is a problem in the building of their organizations in America, but they imported into America the same traditions that they knew back home, and they expected us to accept these as a status quo. But now, when this new generation of empowered American Muslim women say enough is enough, they have to respond. And so last summer, all of the major Muslim organizations came out with a report about making mosques women-friendly, you know, asserting an affirmative action program for mosques. And we, you know, don't leave it to them to make the space receptive to us. We're creating our own new realities. And so last March, I organized a prayer in New York City where a woman led men and women in prayer, reclaiming a right that the Prophet Muhammad had given a woman in the 7th century, but, you know, centuries of jurisprudence have taken away from us. And it was the shot heard around the world. Muammar Gaddafi came out and assailed us, and every cleric read off of the talking points, you know, of conventional doctrine and challenged us as un-Islamic. But now we've had more of those prayers. And the most important thing is that ordinary women are saying yes in their families. You know, why can't I lead the prayer? Why can't I be a spiritual leader in my family or in my community? A woman gave birth to a baby last spring, and in her home country of Pakistan, when a baby is born, you know, they'll run into the streets just to grab any man to give the call to prayer and whisper it into the baby's ear, a tradition that my father did when my son was born. And her husband wasn't there at the time, and her father wasn't there, just her mother. And her mother said, why can't I do this? and was the one to whisper, you know, the divine call into her grandson's ear. And to me, that's the power of breaking our silence, is that all other women can and other men can, because men too are standing up and feeling like they can now have their rightful place in the faith as moderate and strong and inclusive and just-minded men. So ours is a revolution that is vital for the future of our world. The extremists and all of the faiths are basically, I think, trying to destroy peace and civility between groups. And so I know that within Islam we have to stand up, and I know that people within all of the faiths and within all of society have to stand up. And I know that the challenge is oftentimes also very personal, you know, that we have to stand up with courage in our families, in our departments, in our classrooms, for what we really believe if we're going to change the course of the world. And so to me, this is the real responsibility that we have and the opportunity that we've got to change the course of history.
Asra Nomani spoke at Yale University in 2006. Afterwards, she sat down for a talk with Wings reporter Melinda Tuhus.
How has your mom responded to your activities?
Well, my mom is standing by me all the time. She refused to go to the mosque for years because there wasn't a space for her, and she wasn't about to force her way in. But when her uppity daughter came along and said, "I want to go to the mosque," she hung by me. I mean, she went in the first time, she went in the next time, she went in the time after. And finally, recently, she stopped going because she just said that, you know, the eve of the prayers, Thursday night, she'd start getting headaches from just thinking about going into this space that was so hostile. So she watches my son now that he's running around and isn't, you know, place of worship material. And so, but she stands by me. It's amazing. And she feels like our generation is able to do what her generation wanted to do.
And how's the relationship related to this between your parents? Has it been stressful at all?
It has been stressful. You know, despite my father's great support, you know, he has had to lose his place in the community. He stands by what I want to do, but it's so intense because the other wives don't push their husbands on this, right? And It's a sacred male space. And so now that his wife is entering into it, it raises all of these strange feelings that I don't know if he has completely processed himself, but my mom says, you know, sometimes he'll go to the mosque without telling her. You know, he slips out the door. And it's because I think it's such an awkward experience. I mean, we're really creating new experiences for our family and also our community, and we're just walking baby steps through it.
When you did these things, like going to the mosque and, I guess, leading prayers, that was in New York City, you said, right?
Yeah.
In a way, it almost seems like, well, you've shattered the barrier and now everything's easy, but tell me more what that's like when you did that, but it's still not easy.
Well, it was amazing. You know, I had been used to hearing that women cannot go into the mosque. And then when I finally went into the mosque, I was told, okay, fine, you can stay here, but sit in the back of the mosque. And I knew that we weren't going to have real progress and we weren't going to have full justice unless we went from the back of the mosque to the front of the mosque. You know, the front of the mosque is symbolically the pulpit, like it is in every place of worship, and it is the place of leadership. And so if women can't be leaders, then we aren't fully expressed. So I was really committed when I learned that women can be imams in our Muslim world to make this a reality. So it was profound for me to have been told time after time to stay in my corner, and for me at that moment to stand in the front of a congregation in the front row was phenomenal. I addressed the congregation. I'd never done that before.
Now, this was in New York.
Right. I didn't wear my headscarf because I don't believe that that is a mandatory rule on women in Islam. And I had to enter every mosque in the world with a scarf, you know, pretending to be somebody that I am not, and pretending to accept theological doctrine that I don't. And I felt spiritually free. It was so powerful, and it was so empowering.
You said you learned that women can be imams. Did you learn that when you went to the Hajj?
No, you know, the Saudi Arabia still practices the most strict interpretation of Islam's theology called Wahhabism. And in Wahhabism, you know, they don't allow women to drive, they don't allow them to be imams, they don't allow them to speak in mixed congregations. And so I learned this when I came back to America, and I joined forces with fellow disenfranchised Muslim women. And I started talking to the scholars, and they told me about the history of women's leadership in Islam. And on the banks of the Monongahela River in Morgantown, West Virginia, I came together with a group of women and one man for a march on the mosque in Morgantown. And that morning of the march, we prayed together with a woman leading our mixed gender congregation in prayer, because I had learned the name of Waraka, the woman in the 7th century who had led women and men in prayer. And she, like so many women in global history, has been erased from the books.
Yeah, I was raised Catholic, and it's very interesting to see, you know, that all this stuff was also not part of the original thing. And it was, and that, you know, there's different interpretations of the role of Mary Magdalene and other women, you know, early on being much more equal, and then it all, you know, kind of the patriarchy came in, and they, all these ridiculous laws about only men can be priests and they're supposed to be celibate, and it's gonna send the Catholic Church into the ground, but if they don't change it. But it's,
well, you know, we're living our own Da Vinci Code in the Muslim world, and I get as many letters from women in the Catholic faith who are as frustrated as we are by the way they've been marginalized in organized religion. And so I was thrilled to go to Italy last year and come together with the bad boys and bad girls of the Catholic faith who are challenging the doctrine, you know, under the shadow of the Vatican. And it was amazing. I went to a mass where the Catholic women were the leaders, and I thought it was just beautiful. And of course, you know, they're not officially recognized, but they're asserting their faith system, and that's what we have to do.
You know, I'm old enough to remember when I was a child, women's roles in this country were incredibly restricted.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily by religion, it was just the way things were, you know.
Right.
There were like three jobs you could have, and, you know, you were expected to stay home with your kids and all of that. And it's just changed. In fact, my daughter, who's 27, read a lot of that stuff. She's just reading it now. And she's saying, wow, did you live in those times?
Right.
So what's your prediction about where this is going to go for Muslim women?
Well, I really firmly believe that Islam was born with feminist theology. It was in place in the 7th century as a feminist doctrine. And we have had centuries of amazing feminists dotting our history. Women who went from India on the Hajj, queens who ruled countries and nations, and women who went into battle, women who were theologians. But like every other society, we've lost touch with them, and now we're waking up. And there is this global awakening of Muslim women. I think that September 11th really made us realize that our faith has been sold out by a bunch of men who have defined it in the world, and we have been complicit in this conspiracy, really, of extremism that's been allowed to exist. And if we stand up as women, then we stand up against extremism, because extremism always puts women down along with other people. And so I think September 11th has been a catalyst for a lot of women, especially here in America, who realize that the right decision is not to just stay on the sidelines, that we have to get back in the battle. And now through the internet, we share stories. We're hearing about each other, and we're, I think, on the brink of a real mobilization worldwide. Like, a lot of people are doing their work separately right now, but I think we're now getting to know each other and connect.
And what about the role of non-Muslim women in supporting Muslim women or women of other faiths. There's that whole thing about trying to be culturally sensitive or being criticized for not being culturally sensitive if you sort of speak out, but then what's really the most important things to be defending or opposing?
Well, you know, sexism is universal. This phenomena crosses across all identities, and we need our sisters of other faiths to stand with us. Obviously, it's best if Muslim women can be leaders in bringing about reform in our Muslim communities, but we need the presence of women from other faiths. It is so lonely standing in my mosque behind, you know, a couple hundred men, and whenever I can have a woman who's Christian or Jewish or Hindu stand beside me, I feel less alone. And you know, we need to put aside political correctness and cultural relativity, because there is a very clear injustice going on in the way that Islam is being interpreted by men to the cost of women's rights, and they shouldn't be allowed to get away with it. And what women in the West have is an amazing network of Muslim feminists out there that they can join. We have organizations in Malaysia, Nigeria, Mali, Morocco, and America, and we need to just join forces. And you know, especially a lot of women are involved in interfaith or events, and they don't need to accept sitting in the basement when they go with their husband to support Muslims in their community. I mean, they need to understand that that kind of you know, segregation is offensive to Muslim women also. Not all Muslim women, but to many of us, and that's the kind of rights where I think we have common ground. And many of us, Muslim women, hope to put together a school of jurisprudence that challenges the current schools of laws that define our Muslim world. This is something that, you know, our community thought could not be done, because we had to just live with these schools of law that men had created centuries ago. But these schools have failed us into the 21st century. And we had our first Congress on Islamic Feminism in Barcelona in October 2005. That was sort of like the Muslim Women's Seneca Falls. It was a really powerful meeting where Catholic women were standing with us, you know, Spanish Catholic women who were just frustrated by the way they were shut out of the church.
I was just in Seneca Falls myself last summer for the first time. And yeah, have you been there?
No, I really want to go there.
It's really, I loved it. Oh. And I really fell in love with Elizabeth Cady Stanton. You know, I don't know how much you know about the split in the movement, you know, in the 19th century. There were abolitionists who worked with the feminists, the suffragists, and at some point, you know, they split, almost all of them split, and they said, well, we have to give black people, black men,
right,
the right to vote, and then we'll get to the women. Well, of course, passing the law allowing blacks to vote was only black men.
Right.
And so I used to think, well, yeah, that's right, because I wanted to be anti-racist, and, you know, I thought, well, they, you know, should wait. And then I realized it didn't have to be that way. Everybody
right.
could have gotten it,
right.
And that's what Elizabeth Cady Stanton was saying. She and Susan B. Anthony were traveling around the country, and Susan B. Anthony said, women need the vote. The vote will basically solve everything. And Stanton was really firm that that wasn't going to be the solution, and how right she turned out to be.
Right.
You know, she was talking about this whole revolution in all areas of life. I mean, I think she was just an amazing person.
I get a lot of lessons from the suffragette movement. I mean, you know, we're really in the beginning steps of developing our movement, and we are having the kind of splits that the suffragettes had over issues of strategy and priorities, and you know, that's the kind of stuff that can potentially kill a movement. But when I look at history, I see that that is part of the process of movement. You know, you don't always have consensus and agreement and understanding that includes everyone. The civil rights movement was filled with different divisions of strategy, and so it's really great for me to look back at those personalities and their different priorities, because that's what's playing out now in the Islamic feminist movement. And to me, like, it's all moves towards progress, and that's vital.
Can you say a little more about some of those splits, like women, Muslims who are all feminists but still have differences? Like, you know, is it sort of a question of how fast to go, or how much to push, or how much to be in your face, or
right.
is that the kind of?
Yeah, you know, with the suffragettes, you know, they had a split over whether or not they were going to go on into the streets, and Alice Paul took the demonstrations into the streets and then went into prison. So we have had that kind of split also, where I believe that we have to have action, we have to have an assertion of our rights in the mosques. Others believe that it's not the right time because of the post 9/11 climate against Muslims, civil liberties in some cases, and so they don't want to put a spotlight on issues within the Muslim community. And others believe that you need to have a political critique also of, you know, what is happening to Muslims in the world, included with this issue of women's rights. And so, you know, there's those kind of splits in strategy. There's women who believe that you can't seek the imam position. You know, you have to protect that last tradition in Muslim society, and they don't want to go there. There are others who think that there should be no media attention to this kind of internal struggle.
I guess you're not one of those, huh?
Yeah. You know, my life as a journalist tells me that, you know, we have to have a public debate and conversation, and I'm not afraid of it. I believe that it's a vital process. Public debate is a vital part of progress. And so I definitely have a parting with others in the movement. And to me, that's all fine. You know, like, I don't take any of it personally. I don't think it's a failure in any way. I just think it's part of the process.
I just wanted to clarify one thing. You were born in India, but then you said you went to Pakistan and had a lot of relatives in Pakistan. So,
yeah, my family was part of the families divided by the partition of India into India and Pakistan. So half of the family went to Pakistan after partition.
What do you see as things unfolding in Iraq with women's rights in particular? From things I've heard is that, you know, as bad as Saddam Hussein was, that Iraqi women had more freedom than any women in the Middle East, and that that's now been completely curtailed.
Yeah, I think the situation for women in Iraq has gone backwards. You don't have to look any further than the preamble to the new constitution. It literally states that we are the sons of Adam. There's no mention of the daughters of Adam. There's no mention of Eve. The women are erased from the preamble. Later on, you go into it and they assert women's rights and try to have a quota system for the legislative part of the government. They have all of these protections, but they have in the Constitution a clause that says that Islamic law will be a source for judicial decisions, and that's problematic because while I firmly believe that Islamic law is and can be progressive, I know that the way it's interpreted in reality in the world today is puritanical and strict and narrow-minded, and in most cases women are denied their full rights. And so I don't trust the way Islamic law is interpreted and carried out in our modern-day Muslim world. That's our challenge, is to change that. But it's not going to change today. And as long as the Islamic law is used as a source, women are going to have their rights denied in family law, personal law, property rights. And this is not a good thing.
The review of your book in the Washington Post, I think it made some reference to women, you know, sort of your generation who are reclaiming Islam as looking to sort of save the faith from the sexism that's permeated it for hundreds of years, as opposed to just being secular
right.
Muslims who really aren't that concerned or involved with their faith.
Right.
Would you say that you are in that category of somebody who's for whom the faith has become sort of paramount?
There is a very huge divide within the feminist movement in Islam between the secular feminists and those that use Islam as a source for their feminist work. And I definitely fall into the category of being an Islamic feminist. I think I would give up on the faith if I didn't think that it could be a source of feminist theology. I would go become a Methodist or, you know, one of these other theologies that's already gone through these battles. I would have signed up with our United Methodist Church, you know, across the river in Morgantown, and gone where they have already fought these battles and won them in many ways. But we are fighting for the faith. That's how I see it, because if we give up on it, we've given up the religion to the most puritanical and extreme, and we cannot do that. And I argue that a gender jihad, the struggle for women's rights, it's part of a wider peace jihad and struggle for peace, because when we win women's rights, we win a more tolerant Muslim world. You know, we don't want to just walk in through front doors and sit in the front rows. I mean, we want to really influence the way Islam is expressed in the world.
Asra Nomani, author of the book Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She was talking with Melinda Tuhus of Wings. For more information about Asra Nomani and to find a report on making mosques more women-friendly, visit the website www.asranomani.com. That's A-S-R-A-N-O-M-A-N-I. asranomani.com. To hear this series again, visit the archives at www.wings.org. Our thanks to local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.